Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe.
So hi, in today's episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast, our guest is Marisol Lebrun. Marisol is an assistant professor in the Department of Mexican American and Latina Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. She is the author of Police, Life and Death, Race, Violence and Resistance in Puerto Rico, and is the co-editor of Aftershocks of Disaster, Puerto Rico Before and After the Storm. Marisol is completing a short book which reflects on the massive uprisings that rocked Puerto Rico during the summer of 2019. She's also currently working on a book called Shared Geographies of Resistance, Puerto Ricans and the Uses of Solidarity. Marisol is also one of the co-creators of the Puerto Rico syllabus and one of the co-editors of The Abusable Past. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Marisol. I'm so looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so before delving into our conversation, I just want to provide listeners with a brief context of what will inform our conversation today. So last year in July 2019, approximately 400 to 500,000 people took to the streets in Puerto Rico to demand the resignation of Governor Ricardo Rosselló. The mass mobilization was not a spontaneous event, but rather a buildup of Puerto Rican rage and frustration that had culminated over the years, particularly due to the debt crisis, recession, the fiscal control board, devastating effects and response of Hurricane Maria, and action that gained political momentum during the Puerto Rican university strikes and May Day protests in 2017 and 2018. The events leading up to Rosselló's resignation was met with intense confrontations with the police and police brutality. Though Rosselló was ousted, most recently in January, hundreds protested against the emergency aid that was unused and kept in a warehouse amidst the earthquake which has devastated the region. Also, in the aftermath of the police killings of George Floyd, Puerto Ricans rose up in the streets, violating imposed curfew, not only to express solidarity against racist police killings in the US, but also called an end to racism and police brutality in the Commonwealth while blaming local officials for the death of Black residents. So today in our conversation, I'm hoping we can speak to these issues and topics, the uprisings in Puerto Rico, the debt crisis, Hurricane Maria, policing, sovereignty, the Puerto Rico syllabus, and liberation. So to begin, Marisol, I'm just wondering if you can speak about the mass uprisings that took place last year in Puerto Rico, and perhaps explain what led to mobilize, or what led to the mobilization in the thousands to oust the governor.
Yeah, so the uprisings last year were definitely cumulative, right? They, I think, exploded in a certain way that was very kind of urgent and seemed to be really fast, right? And so like the protests were essentially less than 2 weeks before the governor was actually ousted, right? And so I think a lot of people saw that and were like, oh, this is this kind of massive like explosion of public sentiment, and it was. But I think one of the key things, which, you know, your intro kind of gestures towards, right, is that this was an acute, these were grievances against the governor and the state in Puerto Rico that had been accumulating not just months, not just years, but decades, right? And they were kind of intimately connected with the feeling that the ruling elites in Puerto Rico, whether they're kind of the local government officials or the federal government, were not acting in the interest of Puerto Ricans and actually acting against the interests of Puerto Ricans, right, in order to kind of facilitate capital development and extraction and in order to kind of maintain the status quo of the colonial relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico. So, you know, in terms of some background, the kind of what precipitated the actual protests were this massive leak of, you know, thousands of text messages that were exchanged in this group chat on the Telegram messaging service between the governor and kind of a number of members of his cabinet and kind of advisors, some of whom were not even government officials. There was like confidential government business that was discussed in these chats. But the kind of content of the chats really exposed the kind of, for lack of a better phrase, kind of overgrown frat boy mentality of many of the kind of those in power in Puerto Rico. It really exposed for a lot of folks in a kind of very visceral way, this kind of elite power structure of just kind of cruel and indifferent wealthy men and white kind of Puerto Ricans. They, you know, are kind of making these decisions that are life and death decisions for the most vulnerable in Puerto Rico, and then making jokes about the kind of violent outcomes, right? And so in terms of the content of the chat, they were incredibly homophobic, they were incredibly sexist, they were making fun of poor people, they were making fun of Black people, all of that kind of stuff. There's one part where Miranda, one of Rocio's advisors, makes a joke kind of parroting Trump, and he says, "Oh, I saw the future and there were no Puerto Ricans there and it was beautiful," right? Like this kind of really clear disdain for the population, right? And so journalists have noted that journalists and scholars have noted that what is clear is that the elites govern a population that they don't know, right? Mm-hmm. That they're so kind of separated and that there's this clear disdain. And so when the chats came out, you know, a lot of the kind of focus on the chats was that, you know, they had used some kind of really derogatory language towards women and queer folks. So they had, said that certain elected officials were putas, that they were whores, like all of this kind of, like super derogatory kind of vulgar language. And that's kind of what caught people's attention. But I think for most people, the kind of insults of the chat really revolved around the ways in which there was just this utter disdain that was killing people, right? And so one of the things that comes out in the chat is that while feminists were having a massive kind of protest and were, it was called a plantón, and they were doing basically like a sit-in outside of the governor's mansion, demanding that the government act to declare a state of emergency against the kind of femicides that are occurring in Puerto Rico and the incredibly high rates of domestic violence. And as these women are basically being, women and their allies are being kind of clubbed by police, as the police try to dislodge them from the street adjacent to the governor's mansion, they're joking in the chat about like, "Oh, these are just like some little kittens that nobody cares about, they don't have any impact," and just cracking all of these kind of jokes. And so I think that for people is what was kind of clear from the chats, and it was like the vulgar language was only just the kind of, you know, cherry on top of what was already this really horrific kind of example of the kind of corruption and disdain for the population, right? And for Puerto Ricans and Puerto Rico, right? There was also a ton of other stuff that came out where they were talking about using the police in a political capacity to go after rivals. So Manuel Natal they had said that they were gonna get the police on him, like all of this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of examples, I mean, just, you know, thousands of examples of just corruption and inappropriate behavior and disdain. And so the protests really were focused on that. And so I think the US media diminished that as this kind of, one of the things that we saw in the protests was that the chats were the catalyst, but that the roots were much deeper, right? So people were out in the streets demanding for Rosselló and other members of his administration step down because they were anti-debt, because they were feminists, because they were queer, because they were anti-racist, right? And there was a way in which the chats just exemplified the ways in which all of these issues had been ignored and the ways in which the government had exacerbated vulnerability to harm, right? And so I'm working, as you mentioned, on a project right now, and it's a small kind of bilingual pocketbook, like a little short book that's looking at the protests and the argument that I make. So it's called Against Puerto Rico. And the argument that I make is that what the protests were about was about kind of affirming Puerto Rican life, right? And rejecting these policies that the government had been pursuing that were part of this colonial design that promote death, right? Or promote inability to live a full and a life and a life with dignity in Puerto Rico for Puerto Ricans, right? And so, you know, the argument that I make is that we can consider colonial elites as trying to turn Puerto Rico from Puerto Rico to Muerto Rico, to kind of dead island, right? And so with the protests, you know, the kind of argument that I make, and which is, you know, just building, I think, from the kind of stuff that activists are saying, is that these were protests that were about life and death for people. They weren't just about vulgar chats. They weren't just about kind of, oh, this is a corrupt government. Like, the corruption was part of it, right? The vulgarity, the disdain is part of it, but it's part of this larger kind of structural issue that's about the debt, that's about the colonial relationship, that's about anti-Blackness, all of that kind of stuff that brought people out to the streets.
Mm. Thank you. That's super helpful. So actually, because you've talked a bit about the colonial relationship and brought it up a few times, for listeners that might not be aware of Puerto Rico's history, especially in relation to the U.S., could you just explain what that colonial relationship has been? I do ask about it a bit later again, but, you know, I just thought as a preemptive, a little bit of background. So when I refer to it later, you know, it'll make sense.
Yeah, for sure. So Puerto Rico is currently a Commonwealth of the United States, so which is basically a kind of ongoing colonial status. So Puerto Rico becomes a kind of colonial territory of the United States in the War of 1898 against Spain. It becomes a kind of colonial like war prize, right, for the United States, along with, you know, the Philippines. Basically, it's this kind of very overt colonial possession in the first half of the 20th century. But with the kind of increase of decolonization movements in the mid 20th century, and in particular pressure from the kind of UN Decolonization Committee to resolve this kind of colonial status, the United States comes up in kind of close cahoots with local elites in Puerto Rico for a way out of that designation of that kind of overt colonial status. And they come up with this idea of the kind of free associated state or the Commonwealth, right? And the idea is that essentially Puerto Rico has sovereignty in local affairs to a certain degree, right? So they have a democratically elected governor, you know, there's a Senate, all of this kind of stuff. And in terms of local governance, there's a degree of sovereignty. However, that sovereignty is subject essentially to the plenary powers of Congress, right? So Congress has the ultimate say over anything having to do with Puerto Rico. So one of the things that's come up after Hurricane Maria and all of the kind of stuff with Donald Trump and his disdain towards Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans has been people saying, like, oh, can't, like, we just get rid of Puerto Rico? Like, can't we just sell them to someone else? And there was, like, rumors that supposedly Donald Trump was, like, actually trying to, like, trade Puerto Rico for something. I can't even keep up with the details because it's so outrageous. But what that actual example shows is, like, if you study kind of Puerto Rico's legal history, like, they could, right? Like, the Congress could decide what it wants to do with the status of Puerto Rico. And what we've seen is, like, Puerto Ricans have tried to decide that status and have had that kind of squashed by congressional powers. And so the kind of clearest example of that we see, and we can talk more about this kind of in greater detail, is the kind of Promesa law and the imposition of a fiscal control board in Puerto Rico that's basically completely accountable to bondholders of Puerto Rico's debt and Congress, and that's appointed by the president, and that it has the ability to kind of override the local government, right? In making decisions about like how to spend the budget, right? How to spend Puerto Rico's budget. The other kind of way that we see this is like Puerto Rico has local sovereignty, and they have their citizens, right? Puerto Ricans are citizens since 1917 and the Jones Act. But one of the things that we see is that despite the fact they're citizens, if you're in Puerto Rico, you can't vote for president, right? You can only vote for president if you are living in the continental US in one of the 50 states. And Puerto Rico sends the resident commissioner to Congress, but they're a non-voting member of Congress. So there are issues that relate to Puerto Rico that are being discussed, and they're the elected representative for Puerto Rico that sends Congress is basically in an advisory capacity, right? So we see this kind of second class citizenship, this colonial form of citizenship that endures, right, today, and that endures despite this kind of Commonwealth status, right, and the kind of allegation that it's different from a colonial relationship.
Super helpful. So actually, as you sort of started to talk a little bit about the economic, you know, aspects of this, Puerto Rico has not just been struggling with a political crisis, but also an economic one. Can you provide some historical context specifically of the debt crisis to help listeners understand the roots and also how it has detrimentally affected people's lives materially?
Yeah, so I was getting into this a little bit, but basically, in, you know, Puerto Rico's been in a kind of prolonged financial crisis, right? And so I think folks like to point to the past decade, two decades as kind of an origin point. A lot of folks note that when the 2008 crisis happens, that's when things kind of really get intense and terrible in terms of the fiscal situation in Puerto Rico. But, you know, Puerto Rico had already been in a period of financial decline. That was kind of like the nail in the coffin, but it had already been in kind of significant decline. And one of the ways for us, I think, to conceptualize Puerto Rico's kind of fiscal condition and the factors that lead up to the debt crisis is really that related to the Commonwealth, when Puerto Rico becomes a Commonwealth, alongside that new political status, there is a kind of development scheme implemented by both federal and local officials that really tries to rapidly industrialize the archipelago, right? And in particular through manufacturing. And so there's, you know, all of these factories, hundreds of factories that open, officials from all over the world come to look at the so-called Puerto Rican miracle, where it had gone from a largely agricultural, rural kind of community with kind of a system, plantation system, to a rapidly industrial kind of country. And what was happening is that the Puerto Rican government was giving these massive subsidies to foreign investors, to US firms to come and build factories in Puerto Rico, and had promised a kind of cheap, flexible labor force, right? That were citizens, but that you didn't have to pay minimum wage to, all of this kind of stuff, right? And so during that time, living status increases, right? People start living longer, people make more money, but it was this kind of financial development scheme that could only last so long, right? Because essentially what happens is that capital, in search of greater profits, right, goes to other places in the global south that are more exploitable, right? And so there's a way in which Puerto Rico's development and its financial status, even though it was held way above the rest of the, you know, it's the shining star of the Caribbean, because it's not this kind, it's not perceived as this incredibly impoverished and whatever kind of country in relation to its neighbors, but then the industry leaves, right? And so there's all these schemes that the government tries to like get new kind of industries in. So It's like the petrochemical industry, refining. There are all of these laws around and incentives for refining companies to go to Puerto Rico to do refining work. And then the OPEC crisis happens and that collapses. Then there's like kind of medical instruments. And then, you know, basically until the kind of special concessions that Congress had given to Puerto Rico to attract capital get repealed, and then Puerto Rico's left with no, like, with its pants down, right? Like, no kind of plan, no nothing. And so that's really where the roots of the debt crisis are. So, I mean, one of the things for us to think about is that the debt crisis is not rooted in this kind of mismanagement of funds on the part of Puerto Rican officials. It's not about corruption, although those things are there, right? The roots of the debt crisis, we have to think about them as really related to a failed colonial development model, right? That dates back to 1898, but that, you know, gets worse and worse in the second half of the 20th century. And so by the time that the 2008 crisis happens, right, Puerto Rico had already been in kind of emergency mode, trying to figure out what to do and actually engage in massive public borrowing during that time, right? So basically, in the absence of a development model, public borrowing and infrastructural kind of these massive infrastructural projects, right, and the bonds associated with them become the kind of development program, right? And so that's where we get to the point of the figures, right, depending on if we're counting pensions or not, we can say that about $79 billion in debt, or $120 or $130, not giving the exact number, approximately, around there, if we're also counting kind of pensions and other kind of government debt responsibilities, right? And so what happens essentially is that the federal government basically imposes austerity as the only response, right? And so with the Promesa Act, which passes under Obama in 2016, we get this fiscal control board, which we've seen in places like Detroit, we've seen in places like New York, but the difference between the kind of living standards in New York and Detroit versus Puerto Rico, which has like a fraction of the income of the poorest state, right, in the country, right, where people are not making money even to survive, to then force more and more and more austerity on the population, that was seen as the solution, right? So Puerto Ricans have been protesting the imposition of Promesa. One is a colonial kind of, overt colonial kind of tactic, right? That subverts Puerto Ricans' ability to make decisions about how to deal with the debt crisis. But also because there's, I mean, people really feel like how much more austerity can they take, right? I mean, they're the kind of cuts to public education, to infrastructure, to health, all of that has just been so detrimental. And that's why also during this period of financial crisis, we've seen massive migration of Puerto Ricans to the continental US, right? Particular places like Florida, New Jersey, the South, right? Kind of new Texas, new destination places where the cost of living is lower. And then also they're going to be able to have access to any kind of public good that is missing in Puerto Rico.
Right. So, I mean, as you speak to this reality, then I'm just wondering, when the hurricane, Hurricane Maria came, you know, which was a deadly Category 5 storm in 2017, how did that disaster exacerbate this economic situation and also the political and social crisis that we've been already seeing sort of, boil over the decades?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're definitely related. I think you can't talk about one without the other in a lot of ways, right? Because the debt crisis and the kind of rounds, the decades of austerity that Puerto Ricans have been dealing with is why the storm was so bad, right? So it was already, you know, I think in many ways clear that it was going to be a bad storm because it was Category 5, right? And so it was obviously going to create damage, it was going to create harm, but I think the degree to which, you know, thousands of people were killed as a result of this, both the storm itself, but the neglect that followed in its wake, right? there's a clear connection between the austerity that people had been dealing with and the deadly effects of the storm. And so this is something that Yarimar Bonilla and I talk about in the collection and Aftershocks of Disaster, right? But you have to understand the effects of Hurricane Maria is not like this natural disaster, but it's entirely man-made in some ways, and man-made in terms of relating to this longer history of colonial crisis. But there's a way in which you can see the debt crisis as a clear precedent for it, because for instance, one of the blackout that happens after the hurricane in Puerto Rico is one of the longest in any U.S. jurisdiction. And the reason why that is because the Puerto Rican power authority had been starved of resources for decades. And so they were unable to keep up with necessary infrastructural improvements, right? So that's part of the reason why people were in the dark for 2 months or more, right? The other thing that we see is that people, there were issues with kind of water, all of this kind of stuff, and the government was slow to respond because the government is also starved of resources, right? And so what that does is create a kind of need then for citizens to do things themselves, right? In response to these kind of neoliberal austerity, colonial austerity expectations, right? And so there's a way in which Puerto Ricans really stepped up, right? Both Puerto Ricans in the archipelago, but also particularly in the diaspora, right? We're expected essentially to subsidize things that the government should have been doing, right? And so I know there was a ton of people in the diaspora that were trying to figure out how to send, solar panels and generators and all of it. And like, you know, my dad's in Puerto Rico and he was like, can you figure out how to order a generator from Amazon for me? Like all of this kind of stuff where, you know, on the one hand, it shows that people were engaging in this really incredible mutual aid efforts, right? But on the other hand, it's like really goes to show how absent the state has been and what the kind of deadly effects of that are, right? So I think, you know, there's a way in which also because of the debt crisis, there's been increased migration to the United States. And in particular, the folks who are leaving tend to be kind of younger people or people with more access that, you know, might have more like middle class, all of that kind of stuff, right? And so what that does is leave behind the most people who are going to be the most vulnerable and susceptible to the kind of hurricane and its aftermath, right? And so that's also why it was such a deadly kind of event for Puerto Ricans, had to do with that, the kind of landscape that the debt crisis had created.
Wow. That's, you know, that just makes me also think about how COVID is probably also exacerbating this even further, as resources are now probably having to be put towards the pandemic when austerity has been, you know, imposed on the archipelago. So it's the one crisis on top of another just makes me really think about how dire the situation is. But actually, you know, moving to policing, because that's also an area that you have written about and know extensively about. I'm also wondering how the mass mobilization, specifically those that were led by labor organizations, feminist, queer, and anti-racist groups, amongst other activist kinds of coalitions and organizations, they have been met with police violence. And in your book, Policing Life and Death, you discuss how Puerto Rico or Puerto Ricans have negotiated and resisted their subjugation to increase levels of criminalization, discrimination, segregation, and harm. And so for listeners who are not familiar with the context of, again, Puerto Rico, can you tell us a little bit about what this scene of policing in Puerto Rico looks like and how folks have been met with police brutality?
Yeah, for sure. So in the book, the kind of argument that I make is essentially we have to understand policing in within its colonial context, right? And so what I argue is that essentially policing has been, and punitive governance in particular, so not just the police, but the entire kind of apparatus that supports the punitive system in Puerto Rico, of which police are one part, they essentially, they have become crisis managers, right? In response to the kind of crisis that's developed as this development model from the mid 20th century starts failing into the late 20th century, right? So by the 1980s, the kinds of incredible gains in living standards and things like that are a distant memory. People are feeling like life is increasingly difficult, it's increasingly dangerous, right? There's this kind of explosion in the informal economy because the employment sector is kind of imploding, where people feel insecurity on every level, right? Personal insecurity, economic insecurity, insecurity in terms of crime, right? And so what we see is that because Puerto Rico is limited in how it can respond to the crisis provoked by colonialism, the police have become kind of crisis managers, right? They've actually become the key way in which the government intervenes in the lives of citizens and non-citizens in Puerto Rico to manage the effects of that colonial crisis, right? And so I look at, in particular, this one initiative called Mano Dura Contra el Crimen, or Iron Fist Against Crime, which takes place from approximately like 1993 to 2000, that sent National Guard and police into public housing and other low-income neighborhoods to raid and occupy them under the kind of auspices of stopping drug dealing and drug trafficking and stuff like that. And what we see is that essentially it criminalized groups that were experiencing the most dislocation, right? They were experiencing the effects of these colonial crises in the most kind of intense ways. So the argument I make is that low-income Puerto Ricans, economically marginalized, racially marginalized Puerto Ricans experience the brunt of the kind of state's efforts to manage this crisis, right? They become this criminalized locus of all of the problems facing Puerto Rico. But what we see is that people resist that, right? And so in the book, I try to like also like not present policing as a super top-down oppressive apparatus, but look at the ways in which people constantly push back against this punitive policing and try to imagine other forms of justice and safety in Puerto Rico. And so I think like one of the things that we see along with this kind of massive criminalization of economic and racially marginalized folks, right, is also this criminalization of protests, right, in particular protests that challenges the kind of colonial status quo, or that threatens kind of capital development in Puerto Rico. And so we see that kind of, you know, from everything from like the UPR protests, but also in terms of the protests that happened at the University of Puerto Rico, but also like what we saw last summer with the Ricky Renuncia protests to get the governor to step down in the wake of the Telegram chats, right? One of the things that we see is like protesters experienced tremendous amounts of violence. There were allegations that police had engaged in kind of sustained efforts to subvert protests, right, by having like infiltrators or agent provocateurs in the midst of the protests, right? All of this kind of stuff. And really what we see is that it's a pattern and playbook that goes back a really long way in Puerto Rico, and it's very much tied to kind of the colonial status and colonial development in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and I also imagine that, I mean, Puerto Rico has a history of militant organizing, right? So I imagine that these tactics and strategies that are used around policing have also been probably exercised in the past on revolutionaries that, you know, organized forms of resistance. And so, yeah, you know, I think it speaks to sort of the broader historical context in which, you know, policing is so prevalent in repression of
yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things we see is like this massive policing apparatus, both from local police, but also the U.S. federal government too, and like policing pro-independence movement, right? So definitely COINTELPRO was very active in Puerto Rico in the same ways that it was against like Black Power movements and other kind of radical organizations in the U.S. The kind of Puerto Rican version of that was Las Carpetas, which there were hundreds of thousands of files kept on anyone who was anywhere adjacent to any kind of leftist social organizing, right? And that kind of comes out as a result of this case of entrapment, which is the kind of killing at Cerro Maravilla, where the police entrapped these two young men who were pro-independence activists, and they had convinced them to try and blow up a communication tower. They get to the top where the communication tower is, they're ambushed by these police that were there waiting for them, and are executed, right? Once they get up there. And that was kind of this when that case happens, one of the police is on a radio program and he's like, oh yeah, we were keeping these files on all of these groups, right? And we had infiltrators and everything in the same way with COINTELPRO. And then suddenly there's this Senate inquiry into that, right? And these hundreds of thousands of pages of material finally get released. And what you see is that it's been this concerted effort to challenge, to police and criminalize any kind of challenge to the colonial status quo, right? And that continues to this day, right, with the policing of kind of UPR as a site of leftist organizing, kind of the feminist movement, very much the environmental movement in Puerto Rico has also been a site of kind of constant policing. So definitely, you know, there's a long, long kind of history of that kind of politicized attacks against kind of organized labor and the left.
Mm-hmm. So actually moving directions actually to the classroom, you know, you are a powerful educator and have been involved in developing the Puerto Rico syllabus. Can you tell us a little bit about the syllabus? And as educators, what did you hope to achieve with the creation of the syllabus?
Yeah, so the syllabus is actually like one of my, like, especially right now in the midst of this like COVID teaching business, definitely like one of the bright spots of everything. And it's been a project that, you know, grew out of the debt crisis. And so it's, you know, essentially is a website. We just actually did a whole redesign and revamped the website to make it much more user-friendly and much more kind of accessible precisely for folks who are trying to use it in the classroom or activists that are also trying to use it. But essentially it's a kind of website that tries to provide accessible resources and information about the Puerto Rican debt crisis, right? And one of the things that we noticed about the debt crisis is like it is spoken about in these ways as if no one can understand it, which I think is something that marks financial kind of discussions in general, right? It's particularly around debt. It's like this presented in these incredibly economistic terms, like as if no human on earth, except for people who work in banks and in finance, can understand it. And so the result of that becomes the imposition of these incredibly unfair, unequal kind of austerity initiatives, right? Or governing bodies like the Fiscal Control Board, right? Because the assumption becomes the people don't even understand this. There's no way they can actually deal with the crisis. So what we try to do, and on top of that, when people are talking about, like at least in the media about the debt crisis, it tended to be like men and like these kind of figureheads that were just these like economists that were not representing kind of what we felt like were the effects of who was bearing the brunt of the austerity, right? Which is women, which is people of color, particularly Black folks in Puerto Rico, immigrant groups, right? Like, but you know, they were not represented, nor was any of the kind of activism or organizing against the debt represented. So what we tried to do is create this way to, one, create a kind of historical narrative about the debt. So we locate the debt within the colonial crisis and, you know, provide resources about like how to understand Puerto Rico's like colonial history and how that might have contributed to debt. But then we provide like information not only about the debt crisis itself, so like things like PROMESA and the Fiscal Control Board, but also like what the effects have been, right? So we talk about Hurricane Maria, we talk about school closures, we talk about the ways in which it's affected migration, we talk about all of these kind of issues, because what we felt like was that it was just dealt with in this way that was like so overly economistic, that focused on this, like these numbers, right? It was like $70 billion, $120 billion, as if there were not people and behind those numbers, right? They were now more subject to violence, more subject to austerity and all of the violence that that begets, like all of that kind of stuff. So that's what we tried to do with the debt crisis and, you know, or with the Puerto Rico syllabus, is like really try to provide like actually accessible sources on the debt crisis and present it in the most kind of accessible way possible. And so, you know, we've heard from folks, from organizers and stuff that they use it, like folks use it in the classroom and stuff like that. And even I, as someone, like in my own research, I refer to it like constantly, because I'll be like, oh, I need information about this thing, right? Like one example would be like Ley 2022, which is this law 2022, which is this law that actually creates incentives for foreign investors to come to Puerto Rico, especially like, so there's a lot of like Bitcoin and like tech stuff, to come and establish residency in Puerto Rico, and they get these massive tax breaks, but we see that they don't create jobs, right? This is kind of, so it's created actually this kind of apartheid system where there's these enclaves of white Americans who come to Puerto Rico and live in these gated communities with super high tech, you know, like they have the best internet, like they don't deal with any of the same conditions of, you know, that people, normal everyday people are dealing with, right? And so so it's created this kind of really interesting structure in Puerto Rico now, where there's kind of like one set of rules and incentives for foreign investors and another for Puerto Ricans, right? And they don't have access to the same kind of resources or incentives from the government. So that like is something that we put on like information about on the website and try to make that really easy for folks to understand, but also see like what the effects of that are. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, you know, it's so important to be able to take these very complex sort of economic ideas or things that economists are talking about and translate them in ways that can be used not only in the classroom to make, you know, concepts and social relations understandable, but also, you know, I always say this, that in order to solve the problem, we have to understand it, right? And so
totally,
the kind of political education then that is happening also on the outside, like you were saying, activists have reached out and other folks have reached out in terms of the ways they're using it. So having an accessible, having accessible materials that then can be used both to understand theory, but also to understand and have analysis of action, I guess is so important.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So congratulations on that. And, you know, for listeners that are teaching on the region or, you know, are even teaching on colonies or comparative debt or, you know, third world financial crises, like these are even though Puerto Rico is not in the third world, you know, the global South can be attributed in its broader history in relation to the Caribbean. But I want to just move sort of to the final question, which is, you know, Puerto Rico is one of the oldest colonies in the world, and the island people continue, and people continue to be colonial subjects in a sense, despite their resistance. And I'm just wondering, what does liberation mean to you? And what would liberation for Puerto Rico look like from perhaps collective understandings or collective articulations that people express or imagine that, you know, you're privy to?
Yeah, I think this is a super interesting question. And, you know, I come at it as someone who's like in the diaspora, right? Mm-hmm. And is not living day to day in Puerto Rico, but that, you know, it has family there and friends and people that I care deeply about, and kind of see what the effects of the colonial situation are, right? And so, you know, I think I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of like, what does decolonization mean and what does it look like? And, you know, it's a tough question because I don't think there's like consensus around it, right? And I think there's been these kind of really interesting kind of mutual aid and movements like organizing around autogestión or like self-management, right? So this idea around kind of fostering self-sovereignty, right, as this way towards decolonization, right? So like equipping people to do the work that they need to do for their own survival, right? So believing in the idea that people have the tools they need in order to manage their situation, right, and to respond to their own needs. And I think for me, I'm like, that's part of a movement of decolonization, right? I think about abolitionist movements, right? So definitely like part of what I try to think about is like, how do we get rid of these kind of like carceral apparatuses and these punitive policies and stuff like that, right? Because I think that that is the way that these unequal power relations are allowed to continue and stuff like that. But then I think, you know, when you start getting to questions of independence and sovereignty and the variations in sovereignty, you know, that's where you start to see some interesting divergences among what people want, right? And so I think for many people, they all, like most people, agree the colonial situation is not working, right? The relationship with the United States is not what it says it is, right? And it's been kind of the thing that's been keeping it going is fear, right? Because I think it is this unknown of like what would independence, right, or another form of sovereignty look like, right? So for me, you know, I'm pro independence. Mm-hmm. I think Puerto Rico should be free, right? But I think there's a question, right? Like, is it for me? Like, I want Puerto Rico to be free and liberated. But I don't want it to, like, that means there needs to be reparations, right? That means that there's things that need to be in place that don't set Puerto Rico up for failure, right? And I think when you start talking about, like, colonial reparations and things like that, that's the kind of trickier kind of territory, right? And so these kind of plebiscites that Puerto Rico has every so often, right, around, like, independence, the status quo, or statehood, I think people get nervous when they see independence because there's a way in which we've seen in the history of the Caribbean in which independence has actually been this kind of punitive strategy, right? Where colonial nations are kind of cut free and then the old colonial powers actually like collude in order to make that freedom or that liberation fail, right? And so we see that with Haiti, right? And the kind of way in which Haiti was indebted as a result of its uprising and its resistance and freedom, right? But we see that in other kind of Caribbean nations as well. So I think Puerto Rican see that and they get very wary about like what, like people want something different. And I think people are trying to figure out like, within this incredibly unequal world that we live in, within this capitalist world that we live in, right? Like, what does freedom mean, right? And like, how do we get it, right? And so I think that's why we've been seeing these really interesting turns towards kind of micro kind of sovereignty initiatives, right? That are like at a variety of scales, right? Mm-hmm. So that it's not just about the nation, but that it's like about the individual, about the community, all of that kind of stuff. So I've given you a totally inconclusive answer.
No, but that's the point, because if anybody had the right answer for liberation or, you know, non-contested vision for, you know, X amount of million people, then we would, you know, life would be just, it would look different. So I feel like, I mean, you know, I always end with this question because of what the podcast is. You know, like one of the major concepts in the podcast. And it's funny how one thing I'm just realizing is that people have visions and typically collective visions, but, or rooted in, you know, what politically is going on, but ultimately, you know, it ends in the same way where it's like, well, I, you know, this is what we can imagine, or this is what we can hope for, but you know, who knows? And, and in this context, you know, you said 1800s. And so, the colonial relationship, you know, predates or precedes or goes back to that period. So, if freedom hasn't come, it probably will be a long struggle indeed. So, you know, thank you so much for this really, really informative conversation. Thank you so much for the insights that you've provided today, and also for the really powerful and amazing work that you do. And yeah, it's just been so fantastic being in conversation.
This was great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.